Welcome to Cloak and Dagger, our live talk radio internet show.
I could really use some sort of an herbal refreshment.
I'm terrified about the heat. I'm locked the door. And I'm locked the door without the
key. The Almighty says, don't change the subject. Just answer the f***ing question.
You are the wits that make us men.
Don't call me stupid. Don't call me stupid.
I won't go stupid. So will I?
Never trust the limit. Never trust the limit.
Every time Catherine revved up the microwave, and I'd piss my pants and forget who I was for a half hour or so.
Welcome to Cloak and Dagger. Once again, this is a live talk, radio, and internet show. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom. From New York, we are joined by and with none other than the king of media, Bob Dobbs. Good evening, Bob.
Lenny, great to be back and ready to go. I understand our numbers are dwindling.
As well, yes, they're dwindling greatly. As well, we are linked to the internet via our internet spy master, Sleeper. And Bob has advised me, Sleeper, that as media, we are inside you, our audience.
That's absolutely correct.
And our guest this evening, who we will hear from in a moment, from California, is a man who is very concerned with the human condition. His name is Ralph Schoenman, and among his many achievements include the distinction of being the director of the Who Killed Kennedy Committee, along with his associates, Bertrand Russell. But before we come to Ralph and get into that very exciting field, welcome, Bob.
Well, Lenny, I understand that Deep Throat, then he became too deep, his run bailed out. Now it's him and James B. There's only two or three of us left. I feel like Randy Quaid in Independence Day or Butch Cassidy in Sundance Kid, hiding out in the cave, ready to go out shooting. So it looks like you and I and Sleeper are going in.
Yes, we're going in, and we're the ones who have the ammo and the proof. Bob, let's just talk a little bit about, at the beginning of the show, about the week that's passed and last week's show. Last week's show was really exciting with Helky Ferry talking about the drug cartels and their ability to muscle and leverage the College of Physicians and Surgeons and the real hidden power that's manipulating these institutions.
The old IG Farben corporate complex.
And tonight, of course, we're joined by Sleeper, and Sleeper is our internet spy master who's linking us to the internet, and he'll be at mojoradio.com and go to the right-hand column, and you'll be able to click on the Cloak and Dagger link and take yourself into the public forum where you can meet and talk with us and with Sleeper. Good evening, Sleeper.
Hi, no, it's nice to be in studio for a change.
Yeah, you haven't been in the studio here for a while.
You caught the sign outside the station tonight.
No, what did it say?
Well, the new PlayStation ad says, live in your world, play in ours. And I thought that was, we're the fitting juxtaposition of that, because it's time to play in your world and live in ours.
Yes, that's right. Play in your world, but live in ours. And phone in. And we should give out the phone numbers. What are the phone numbers? Do we know the phone numbers? Nick, have you got the phone numbers there?
I got them right here.
Give
it's
them out, Nick.
870-6400 *640 on the cell.
Yeah, and mojoradio.com. Click on the link, click Cloak and Dagger, click and dagger on the right-hand column. Bob, what about the week? Last week you talked on this show about Bin Laden being dead after the news media was reporting what he had to say. And, of course, this week the media turned out that you were right, Bob. There's a report here from the major Middle East papers that Bin Laden is dead. What about it? How did you know?
Well, he got killed in November, December. But the point is, that's his physical body. And I will later explain as a neuron body. But the problem is that 2 days later, the Irish papers reported that he was still alive and more video coming from him. Now, that's his TV body. That will continue. That will never die.
Yeah, well, Bob, for those of our listeners, I think we should say that we'd love to hear from them. We'd love to hear them call in and give us their comments, give us their ideas, feedback on what they're hearing about what's going on behind the cloak and the dagger. And, of course, the daggers are all out there, and they're still trying to kill us. We've got the sniper was taking all the news and eating everything up. Is that just a big distraction?
No, it's just another part of the war front, which if you consider the war a distraction, yes it is, but I think it's interesting that they've moved from massive devastation to one-on-one. They're oscillating between the collective and the personal.
What do you mean by that, collective versus, what do you mean by collective?
Well, September 11th was a mass murder. All right, now you have a sniper picking us out one by one. Now, what's interesting is that is each one of us, under the elevated, inflated media situation we have with our cell phones, the electronic digital economy, each one of us is confronting each other. So the war is not just mass man, it's individualized, digitalized man and woman, and this sniping is part. It reminds me of Edward Teller's famous dream 30 years ago, where he dreamt of a nuclear war, where he was lined up on one side with a bunch of people, and they were marching towards another lineup, and each person, each man, had to confront one other man and have a battle to the death. So we're oscillating between the individualized electric situation and the collective ESP, the mass man.
Yeah, well, I hope we all understood that. If we didn't understand that out there, and of course they're not out there, Bob, they're inside us and we're in them, but for all those who are near your phone and want to have a good understanding and about it, I'm sure you've got some questions. Call in. Let's get some calls going on this and get back to Bob on this stuff. But we have a break. We're going to the break, Bob, and when we come back, we will be joined by Ralph Schoenman. And, of course, Ralph is an illustrious member of the Who Killed Kennedy Committee, along with his associate, Bertrand Russell. And being that our producer, Nelson Thal, owns WarrenCommission.com, we should get into some heavy Oswald stuff, and we'll talk about things on the net that pertain to smoking guns that help you prove that the JFK conspiracy was exactly that. So let's go to the break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Ralph. Before we get to Ralph, we've got a question here for you, and let's take the call right now. It's line one. We got line two. Line two. Hang on. Here we go, Bob. Hello, Bill. Are you there?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay, basically a question for Bob Dobbs in regards to what exactly is the Android means, and whether what he said about the ESP, are we somehow in some kind of a trance through the media or something like that? And whether that whole thing about the audience being inside of us and we're being inside the audience, is he referring to just simply exchange of information through television, radio, I don't know, advertising, stuff like that?
Bill, I'd like to address that in the second hour. I'm sorry, but I think we need to go to Ralph. He's been left hanging,
okay.
And I want to get into that. That is
well,
a very good
let's
bunch
go
of
right
questions.
To that, Bob.
What?
Let's go right to Ralph.
No, it's just a very good bunch of questions, a big topic. We'll explore that around 10:30 tonight.
Okay, great.
Let's go to Ralph.
Hello.
Ralph,
you there?
How are you doing?
Terrific. Great to have you, Ralph. How things
you.
Out in California?
Right.
Okay, Ralph, let me begin right off. We left off when you were here a few weeks ago, and we were just getting into the Amdocs phenomenon, which is a company in Israel that seems to own many of the phone communications set up in the United States. Can you go into that a bit?
Well, yes. Actually, it's what Israel had done was to set up a government-subsidized telecommunications company, and one of the principal companies is Amdocs, which provides the billing and directory assistance for 90% of the phone companies in the United States. Their main computer center for billing is actually in Israel, and it allows those with access to do what intelligence agencies call traffic analysis, which is to say they have a picture of anyone's activities based on the pattern of who they're calling and when. Now, there's another Israeli telecom company called Converse Information Systems, which subcontracts the installation of automatic tapping equipment, which is built into every telephone system in the United States. And Converse maintains its own connections to all the phone tapping equipment, and Converse has been identified as the source for monitoring and providing information to the Mossad, of course. And then there's yet another linked Israeli telecom company called Odigo, which provides the core message passing system for all instant message services. It's interesting that prior to the attack on the World Trade Center, Odigo employees received a heads up and a warning about the pending attack. And so this is a complex system of electronic monitoring and spying that is linked to Echelon, and it's linked to the Promise software and to INSWA, the whole panoply of intelligence operational spying on a global scale. And it's interesting in this regard, I'll just mention again briefly, we can get into more later, but it was the Echelon spy network which was monitoring all of the communications of the groups that were run by the CIA and U.S. intelligence agencies, specifically the Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and the related groups. And the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is the largest newspaper in Germany, ran a detailed story citing German intelligence sources about how the Echelon network had collected all particulars and information about every operation. In fact, in the U.S., the operatives would joke because when bin Laden would talk to his mother, they would play back the conversations. These people couldn't fart without Echelon and his electronic spy operations monitoring it. The groups were all penetrated. The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung goes into detailed elaboration about how German intelligence, U.S. intelligence, all had a full appraisal of all the movements and plans and operations of these small little groups associated with their client, bin Laden.
Okay, Ralph, what is the significance of this Mossad-linked company in Israel owning and monitoring these situations? What would it mean if Japan had a company? Is there any reason why Israel gets that position, or are they just the lucky company that won the bid?
No, it has nothing to do with bids that are economical. It has everything to do with the relationship of the Mossad and the Israeli state to U.S. imperialism, and it is all together an on-point relationship to the running of false flag operations, be they the blowing up of the World Trade Center, as we've discussed on prior shows in 1993, or the operation that took place on September 11th. Actually, it's interesting to note that the Fox, Israeli press, by the way, has been quite elaborate about this. Haaretz ran a detailed article on September 6th of this year about how Odigo, which is linked to the Amdocs and Converse, had such detailed foreknowledge of the World Trade Center attacks that they had made an elaborate series of dossiers about this, and they confirmed that the instant messaging service provided heads up to all of their operatives and employees in the United States. Mitya Machover, the CEO of the company, confirms that the messages were conveyed, and this is then reported in Le Monde, and then Fox News ran a four-part series on this phenomenon, and that's linked to what ABC's 2020 then went into about the urban moving company and the white van, which is a company that is also associated with Odigo. So we're dealing with the Mossad, U.S. intelligence, false flag operation to create the pretext for a permanent war that has been on the detailed drawing board since the mid-70s.
Oh, that's terrific. Now, Bob, we do have two calls here. Would you like to just grab one?
For Ralph?
Yes.
Yes, for Ralph. And by the way, the line is 416-870-6400 or *640. And on air, you can email us at onair@mojoradio.com. We've got a call here from Chad. Patrick, hang on. Let's go ahead and let's bring Chad on the line. Are you there, Chad?
I'm here.
Okay, Chad, you've got a call, a question for Bob or Ralph.
I have a question for Bob.
Go ahead.
Hi, Bob.
Yes, Chad.
I have a question. How do you know that, okay, if bin Laden's physical body has been reported dead in the media, how is it that we know through the neural body of the media that his physical body has died?
You'll never know through the media. My sources are pretty esoteric. I can't reveal them because then that gets the source in trouble. I'm just saying these things, and I don't expect you to believe them, but I want the record to show later that I said them. So ignore my my predictions until they're proven, and then they have meat. But do you have a question for Ralph, Chad?
No, I heard him on the previous show, too, and I'm just going to sit back here and lurk for a while.
Okay, Chad.
Thanks, Bob.
Are you 400 miles away?
Oh, we lost him, Bob.
Okay.
We lost him, but go ahead. I thought that was a call. I thought it was going to be a call for Ralph. Why don't we go ahead?
With Patrick.
With Patrick. Patrick, go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. I had a question for Bob. I want to know if he thought the Illuminati had a role in founding Islam, specifically in Algiers in the early centuries, if he felt that.
I would like to ask Ralph that. Ralph, address that question.
My own predilections are not to take very seriously the discussions about Illuminati. I think there's a real danger, frankly, that we, from my perspective, contaminate an analysis of how power operates, its precise workings, the institutions involved, the structure of power in our respective societies, by reference to such things as the Illuminati, which is to me a metaphysical fiction. You have in the United States a very clear, definable, documentable structure of power. About 2% of the population controls 90% of the national wealth. They average 14 corporate directorships per person. The head of Avis and American Express, Robert Townsend, calculated at about 5,000 people control what he called the commanding heights of the economy, that's to say banking and corporate finance in the United States. That's a ruling class. And remember this, we have only 5% of the world's population within the frontiers of the United States, yet this tiny little oligarchy has command over 70% of the world's natural resources. It's an empire. And when they need and when they implement wars to steal resources and to impose starvation conditions on working people, it comes out of that kind of design. You don't need a construct like the Illuminati, from my point of view, to understand the structure of power of the ruling class of corporate capitalism over the past 300 years.
Bob, we've got a call from Ron. Let's take this call, and then we can carry on with the whole business about the Israeli spine.
Yes, if it's for Ralph.
Yeah, this one is for Ralph. Ron, go ahead.
This is for Mr. Shulman. When Iraq was attacked the first time, the Gulf War One,
yeah.
Afterwards there was reports that I heard that Japan had paid for the war. And I never read anything extensive about it, and I don't know if that's accurate, but if it is, why was Japan paying for the war? What did they get out of it? What's Japan's connection with all of this?
I don't believe that that's accurate. The cost for the U.S. operations, the terrible slaughter that was inflicted on Iraq, were largely paid for by the Saudis and by the Gulf Emirates out of their huge oil receipts, and that was extracted virtually by blackmail on the part of the U.S. But I think, you know, what's important to keep in mind is that the operation, the Gulf War operation, had been long prepared from the mid and early 70s when all of the major spokespersons for both political parties were discussing the necessity to seize not only Iraqi oil but the oil of the region. That flowed from a very elaborate plan called the Strategy for the 1980s that was prepared by the Mossad and by one of its operatives, Oded Yinon, which detailed the necessity to break each Arab country into its ethnic and religious component. The report was specific in stating that Iraq is first, rich in oil and internally torn. It is guaranteed as the initial target. Its dissolution is even more important than that of Syria. Egypt will then be torn apart like a second Lebanon. The entire Arabian Peninsula is a natural for dissolution, and the matter is inevitable, especially in Saudi Arabia. This was the Oded Yinon plan, which was adopted by Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Kenneth Armitage, Donald Rumsfeld, and Richard Cheney, and what came to be known as the Committee on the Present Danger. And these plans were then analyzed fully in late 1978 by the Brookings Institution with a study called U.S. Armed Forces as a Political Instrument, which they prepared for the Defense Department's Advanced Research Projects Agency. And they drew upon a precedent of 215 military interventions between 1946 and 1975, which were designed to seize resources of dependent countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just mention one other thing in relation to that. A man named Miles Ignotis, which is actually a nom de plume for Edward Luttwak, who was a prime Pentagon intelligence analyst, wrote a report called Seizing Arab Oil. It was ultimately actually published in part in Harper's Magazine in 1975, and it described the necessity for a rapid deployment and strike force to seize Saudi oil fields, installations, and airports, and then prepare for the same operations in Iraq. All of this was elaborately prepared. I could go into many of the other reports. Oil, the issue of American intervention, was one of them. Without intervention, there is a possibility of an economic and political disaster bearing more than a superficial resemblance to the disaster of the 1930s. And the guy, Robert Tucker, said this: the Arab shoreline of the Gulf is the new El Dorado awaiting its conquistadors. That's the operation. That was the antecedent to the Gulf War. They made their dependent little feudal oligarchies subsidize the operation, but it was about crushing Iraq and preparing to seize its oil resources.
Ralph, had you heard this Japanese rumor?
Well, the Japanese have a very intimate relationship to American capitalism because they hold a great number of U.S. Treasury bonds, and it's a primary arena for Japanese investment, and then there's a very symbiotic relationship between the Japanese banking system and that of U.S. capital. But the Japanese were not the paymasters, if you like, of the Gulf War. No, it was European and Middle Eastern emirates that coughed up to for the Pentagon operation.
Yeah. Now we have another call here from our friend Bev for Ralph. So why don't we just go ahead with this call, Bob? We've got Bev on the line. Bev, go ahead. Welcome to Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah. Good evening, Mr. Shulman and people on the show. I wanted to ask you, Mr. Shulman, about Michael Collins' Piper book about Final Judgment.
I'm not familiar with it. Tell me about it.
He goes into that, and I understood you were going to be talking about Kennedy at some point.
Yes.
And he says that the mafia, primarily the Jewish mafia, killed Kennedy, and that there were three things involved, and that Menachem Begin was intimately involved and got in touch with Joey Bishop, who in turn got in touch with Marilyn Monroe, who in turn they gave as a mistress or made sure that it was a mistress to Kennedy. And Kennedy also shared the mistress of one of the mafia dons, and they wanted to get information out of Kennedy to find out, was he going to continue giving billions of dollars in aid to Israel, or was he trying to get rid of the fifth column of Israelis in America? That was one of the things. And the other thing was the Vietnam War. And the other thing was the private bank known as the Federal Reserve, how it was inflicted on the Americans to bleed them dry, and that he was going to get rid of that and establish the American greenback once again. And these were the things that Piper was talking about in his book.
That's not my point of view, quite frankly. I don't think there's much basis for that particular assessment. The Kennedy execution flows, in my judgment, from a dispute. I call it something analogous to Who Killed Caesar. It's the rulers falling out over the spoils, two sectors of capital, Eastern finance capital on the one hand, the Rockefellers, who are largely represented by the Kennedy clan and by the Democratic Party at the time, and new or cowboy capital that was associated intimately with oil and with the arms industry. And it flowed from a number of things. You know, interestingly, the Kennedy brothers were obsessed with what I call counter-revolution on the cheap, namely Green Berets and killer squads and Phoenix programs and assassination units. It's the irony of the thing. Whereas the sector of capital that's completely dependent upon military expenditure, was looking for a massive military intervention out of which they profit in the trillions. And Eastern capital is concerned about the deficit financing that it involves, which is undermining the dollar in relation to other currencies like the mark and the yen and the franc and so on. You look carefully at this structure of the Kennedy execution, you'll note that the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, Alan Dulles, and the deputy director, Major General Charles Cabell, had provided for the plans for the invasion of Cuba, as you'll recall, at Bay of Pigs. Major General Charles Cabell wanted the U.S. to involve its troops directly. The Kennedy brothers wanted to use surrogates and to disclaim direct U.S. Involvement. When Bay of Pigs fails and the Kennedy brothers refuse to send in U.S. troops, Kennedy fires both Alan Dulles and Major General Charles Cabell. The brother of Major General Charles Cabell, Earl, was the mayor of Dallas. Their father was the mayor and sheriff of Dallas before them, as was the granddaddy. Dallas was Cabell territory. Okay. You're talking about an internecine conflict within the ruling class about stratagems and policies for sustaining imperialism in the world. The Israelis are really not... there's no wing of the American ruling class that does not subsidize the Israeli state or see it as a colonial instrument important for intimidating the Arab revolution and the aspirations of the Arab masses to have control over their own resources.
Yeah, Ralph, now hang on. I just have to interrupt here. We do have to go to a break. Bev, stay on the line. One of the interesting things that I find of what you said, Bev, was when Barry Chamish was for the show, he mentioned that in Leah Rabin's book that Rabin was in Dallas on the 22nd. We'll come back to that. Let's take it away.
No, I just wanted to say that when it comes to the question of the mafia, you know, the mafia does not have control over the state apparatus in the United States. The mafia is not capable of shutting down all communications in the immediate aftermath of the assassination. The mafia is not capable of sustaining a total cover-up of the elements of the assassination in all the media of communication. Yes, of course, the mafia has long been integrated into CIA assassination operations. Mafia units have been deployed in all parts of the world by the Central Intelligence Agency, but these are the plug uglies, the contract killers, the hitmen, and they're quite subordinate to state power in the U.S. I mean, an example of that would be Jack Ruby. I mean, Ruby... makes his mark. Interestingly enough, when he grew up in Chicago in the 30s, as a youth, he was in the Young Communist League. But then he became absorbed in the mafia, and in 1939, he was one of the people who killed the Secretary General of the Iron and Waste Handlers local in Chicago, which facilitated the mob move on the Teamsters. And it was with the association and collaboration of the FBI. Then Jack Ruby in 47 shows up giving testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee of Richard Nixon on his spy operations for the FBI within the Teamsters and the trade union movement. So, you know, Ruby is a mafia, a plug ugly and thug who was also a gun running into Cuba for the CIA and the FBI, but these are subordinate figures. So was Carlos Marcello, another mafiosi who did contract operations for protection on behalf of the CIA, Johnny Rosselli, Sam Giancana in Chicago, who were involved in attempts to assassinate Fidel and who are implicated in the implementation of some of the hit teams on the Kennedy brothers. But that comes out of a direction from a much higher authority than theirs, state authority in the Central Intelligence Agency, and military intelligence, and linked to sectors of capital that are basically moving in for their control over state power and their share of the spoils of imperial plunder.
Well, wow, that's really quite an interesting, complex connection, but it's quite interesting, Ralph, in spite of all you really are connecting the dots for the researchers and the Kennedy assassination people out there. While Bev's on the line, Bev, what's the author of that book, Final Judgment, again?
It's Michael
Collins Piper, and it's called Final Judgment. It's very well documented, and it's really worthwhile reading.
What is Michael Collins' credentials?
I don't have them right here to read them to you, but I would advise that you just take a good look at the book yourself and see what you think of it.
Terrific. Well, thanks for calling in, Bev. We welcome your contribution all the time. It's really appreciated.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Okay, Bob, go ahead.
Ralph, you brought up Fidel Castro. This is something that I was interested in exploring with you. You either knew Fidel Castro or Che Guevara or knew people associated with him. How do you see what you did with Che and these people in the 60s relating to events today?
Well, I mean, when I was a student at university, the Cuban Revolution was unfolding, and all of us we identified with the Cuban Revolution against Batista and against the American domination of Cuba after so many invasions and virtual colonization. And in those years, I was in touch with the July 26th movement. A friend of mine and I were the first to translate their program, which was published at the time of the Nation, 1956, and so on. And so I had a relationship to the Cuban Revolution that dates from those years, and when I was living in Great Britain and working with Bertrand Russell and running the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, we worked with the Cubans in resisting U.S. Depredations throughout Latin America and its plans to invade and destroy the Cuban Revolution itself. And without going into too much detail, I was very close to Che, and particularly to his first wife, Hilda Gadea, who had politicized Che. Hilda was a Peruvian militant who Che had met when he was traveling through Latin America as a kid. They met in Lima and then went on to Guatemala, and Hilda and Che were in Guatemala when the CIA overthrew the Arbenz government in 1954. The Arbenz government was a government that was attempting to introduce some form of democratic governance, overthrowing the guerrilla generals who were beholden to the CIA, and immediately a plot was hatched to overthrow this regime. And I'll just mention this quickly for you. What's interesting about that is that the man who was the point person for the overthrow of the Arbenz government in 1954 was E. Howard Hunt. Head of the Domestic Operations Division later of the CIA.
Right.
And the other fellow who was working on this with him was a man named Guy Bannister, who was in the Office of Naval Intelligence and at the FBI office in Chicago. Now, where do you think they were planning this overthrow of Arbenz in 1954? It was in New Orleans at a place called
Lafayette and Camp Street?
Yep, 544 Camp Street.
Oh, my.
And 544 Camp Street was where E. Howard Hunt set up the dummy Cuban Revolutionary Council, which is a CIA front operation intended to take power in Cuba after the assassination of Fidel and the successful invasion. 544 Camp Street was also the office of Guy Bannister.
And the CIA.
And it was also the place where Lee Harvey Oswald's one-man Fair Play for Cuba committee, a complete dummy organization, was headquartered.
We have to
there you see the nexus of the Kennedy execution.
I think we should go to Sleeper. He's been checking out on the internet for us, and he's been checking some things out, and he's got a report for us. Sleeper, what's up?
Yeah, since Bev dropped the name Michael Collins, I did some digging, and it's a very interesting story unfolded because it's clear he's under the same type of smear campaign that Ralph has been on the internet when we actually posted the disinformation about Ralph on our own page and had to be corrected. It looks like he's fallen into that too, because the opinions about this guy online are all over the place.
So okay, thanks, Luther. Ralph, it's interesting, you have a 10-year gap, 653 to 63 involving these offices. Can you link 63 to 73? E. Howard Hunt is in Watergate. Do you see a link to the Rumsfeld gang?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, by the way, Bob, that you asked me about Che. Well, I was with Che in Bolivia. I was in Bolivia for almost 7 months and was put in a military prison after he was killed. So I was very deeply involved with the struggle of Che and of the Cuban revolutionaries, and not just the Cuban revolutionaries. It was also in connection with my role as the at that time as Secretary General of the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Vietnam. This is an effort to resist U.S. imperialism, much as we are all trying to do today with respect to the war that's prepared for Iraq and the permanent war for seizing resources wherever they can. And this really does connect to the assassinations of the time. I'll just mention to you that in 1967, there was an Italian newspaper called Paese Sera that did a six-month investigation into the plans of the CIA to make a coup in Italy, like they had done, they did in Greece, and to install a far-right military dictatorship. And when they were investigating this, quite fortuitously, they came upon data that showed that the proprietorial CIA companies in Italy that were involved in this process for the CIA were included a particular group called Central Mondiale Commerciale, or World Trade Mart, and another called Permindex. And one of its figures was a guy named Clay Shaw, who was a declared persona non grata, and of course Clay Shaw was based in New Orleans. So I sent that stuff to the then DA of New Orleans, Jim Garrison, and then worked with Jim over a period of time, and was hot on the trail not only of Clay Shaw but of the Central Intelligence Agency in relation to the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
We have Ralph Shulman, the executive director of the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, on the line from California, and we have the illustrious Bob Dobbs, who some say is the king of media. But I can tell you this, he has inherited the McLuhan mantle and is dean of the Board of Education and director of the McLuhan Institute. He's talking to us from Manhattan. Go ahead. We had to interrupt you, Ralph. We're sorry about that. Pick it up.
Problem.
And we have some callers.
Sure.
Stand by on the phone, callers. We'll get to your calls in a moment. But go ahead, Ralph, with what you were saying before the break.
Well, we were talking about the dynamics of the Kennedy assassination and about the Cuban Revolution and Che Guevara and such, but I believe that the perpetual plans to destroy the Cuban Revolution were also part of the motivating scenario for types like E. Howard Hunt and the Plug Uglies in the Operations Division of the CIA,
right,
for the Kennedy killing. You asked Bob, you know, the question of E. Howard Hunt's role in Watergate and all. Well, it's interesting that the Watergate burglars, so-called, are people who were working with Hunt CIA assassination operations both in Cuba and in Latin America, and are very much involved in the groups that were preparing the Kennedy killing itself. But there's strong evidence to suggest that the Keystone Cop-like nature of their break-in at Watergate was really an entrapment to take Nixon down. Because some of the scenarios that John Mitchell, his attorney general, and that G. Gordon Liddy and the Nixon crowd were up to, which, by the way, are rather like what the Bush crowd is doing today, were considered by sectors of the ruling class as reckless endangerment. They were going a little far. They were stripping the facade. And as such, they were alienating huge sectors of the population, and so the rulers were pulling back a little bit. And the Nixon takeout, which Watergate represents, was, after all, the revealing of things that had been going on constantly in most administrations, but they chose to nail Nixon for them. Because the main sector of Eastern finance capital was saying enough is enough. We're reining you in a little bit.
Now, Bob, did you want to? I wanted to mention that, by the way, on themedianews.com, which you can get to via mojoradio.com and the Cloak and Dagger click button. Ralph, I've got up on there the Lee Harvey Oswald repatriation loan. People can read it. It's a smoking gun, as we call it, and they can read that and click on the repatriation loan. I thought that would be something that you'd find quite harmonious and a little bit funny.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lee Harvey Oswald was a CIA operative. He was also an informant for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He had a crypto security clearance. He'd worked at Atsugi Air Force Base in Japan, where he was monitoring U-2 overflights of China and the Soviet Union. He was involved in the CIA operations in the Celebes Islands in Indonesia, with the Muhammad Hatta uprising that intended to overthrow President Sukarno. He was really, this young man was deeply involved in intelligence and was sheep-dipped as a leftist in order to infiltrate him in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's a great term, sheep-dipped. It's amazing where how Bannister and Camp and Clay Shaw and Lafayette and Camp Street, which it was a corner, and on one street was the CIA headquarters, and on the back door was all this nefarious black ops operations that was going on.
Well, it was the same building with two addresses. As you say, it was a corner building, and so it had an address on Lafayette, a number on Lafayette, and a number on Camp.
And of course, it was right in the center of the entire intelligence district, with the ONI in the area, the Office of Naval Intelligence, FBI, CIA. Everybody was right there. I mean, you just couldn't be hanging around there and not be someone who was being used and set up or sheep dipped, as you say.
Well, that's why when Jim, you see, I agree with you, Bob, and Jim was, after all, Jim Garrison was a former FBI man. He had the inside track on the governorship of Louisiana. He was in many respects a conventional Democratic Party politician. But the Kennedy execution occurred on his watch, and he, out of all innocence, thought that as he was uncovering the dynamics of the Kennedy killing, that it would be embraced by the Justice Department. And when he found that, on the contrary, they were taking out his witnesses, who were dropping like flies, and that he himself was being completely reinvented and literally destroyed, he began to realize that he was dealing with a government operation. And the more he investigated, the more clear it was from the evidence and from the witnesses that he was in the presence of an effective coup.
Now, Ralph, just to interrupt, we've got two calls here. One's from Michael mm-hmm. on the subject of Arthur Anderson accounting scandal, and the other is on U.S. threatened Eastern oil countries. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, Bob, did you want to field one of those? Or
let's take the first one.
The first one on Arthur Anderson?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. We've got Michael from Portland. I don't know if that's Portland, Maine, or where that is, but go ahead, Michael.
Hello. What I wanted to ask is if you believe that the Arthur Anderson accounting scandal was orchestrated by the European Economic Community to help devalue the U.S. dollar at the time that the euro dollar was making its entrance into the world economic community.
I don't see it that way. You know, what you've got here in this particular era is the capitalist class degenerating into a virtual kleptocracy. And all of the major accounting firms, not just Arthur Anderson, are complicit in this, because essentially huge sums of money are taken out of the country, and they're sheltered in offshore accounts, and then the accounting is intended to create a facade for this.
Ralph, for our listeners, explain the word kleptocracy. Explain that word. A lot of our listeners may not know what that is.
Plutocracy?
Oh, you said plutocracy.
Well,
yeah, I'm sorry.
Or kleptocracy. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, a kleptocracy, sorry about that, is the rule of thieves. They got their hands in our pockets.
Is that what you call it, Bob?
Yes, I call it kleptocracy, but kleptocracy goes hand in glove with it.
Well, kleptocracy isn't a bad term either. They're doing things in secret. They do that too.
Yes, kleptocracy is one of the effects of the kleptocracy.
Right, you're right on.
Oh, Bob, we've got a call. Sydney, U.S. threatened Eastern oil countries for Ralph. Shall we go to that? Yep. Okay, Sydney, welcome to the show.
Yes, I just have a couple of comments here. One is on the history of the oil and gas in the Middle East. I mean, in 51, when Iran nationalized its oil, Britain and the U.S. got rid of Mossadegh. In the early 1970s, Libya nationalized its oil, and they were warned by the U.S. that they would meet the fate of Iran. So what the problem is that they want all the oil privatized, and any country who wants to share the wealth of its resources with its people is going to be threatened with war. So privatization, and it's not even just happening overseas, but we here in Canada, we're now having things like our hydro privatized. This is the kleptocracy. This is out and out thieving from us, taking our assets.
Absolutely.
And saying that they have to be privatized. But when you get right down to it, if you want to go back to Andy Jackson, the very first privatization was of our money and our credit. And three or four presidents at least were assassinated over that, trying to keep the private banks with their hands off our issuance of our own money and credit. So this is why a phony monetary system like they have in the U.S. and now we have here, like the Federal Reserve, and privately owned so-called national banks, I mean, they require wars, because this system of creating money from thin air instead of backing it with your national resources, this system cannot sustain itself without a lot of wars and thieving.
Okay, so do you have a question, Pharrell?
I was just saying I wish people would understand that the very first privatization was of our money and credit, leaving us in debt, terrible debt, so governments are bought and they have to do what they're told. Now, the question I wanted to ask him is this. Ostrovsky, who was a Mossad agent,
yes,
and has written a couple of very interesting books,
yes,
said that at one point the Mossad would support the radical elements of Muslim fundamentalism. They wanted that because an Arab world run by fundamentalists would not be a party to any negotiations with the West. That's leaving Israel, you know, full sway. So he also said, and I'm quoting from Ostrovsky, that if the Mossad could arrange for the Hamas to take over the Palestinian streets from the PLO, then the picture would be complete. So what is your comment on that, Ralph?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say that what you were describing about the dynamics of U.S. capitalism, I consider to be right on. Bear in mind, of course, that the Federal Reserve is really run by the private banking system in the United States.
Absolutely.
And you really, what we're talking about here is how the state is the milk cow of this corporate and banking ruling class. The state is no more than the corporate soup line that subsidizes their operations, that they don't pay taxes for 10 years at a time, and their profits are never on the books. It's off books accounting. It's largely what we call fictive capital. It's paper shuffling. Increasingly, these huge profits derive from speculation, and they are destroying productive forces on the planet. Just to illuminate that in relation to the way the Pentagon works, as do most of the state institutions controlled by capitalism, the U.S. publication Insight on the News reported on August 10, 2001, quote, every year, trillions of dollars are unaccounted for by federal agents. Robert Lieberman, the Deputy Inspector General of the Department of Defense, admitted that $4.4 trillion in the Pentagon's books had to be cooked to compile required financial statements. The funds had simply disappeared. In 1 year, $1.1 trillion was simply gone. No one knows where and to whom the money was sent. I'm still quoting, untold trillions of dollars are stolen every year and disappear into offshore numbered accounts, holding companies and banks without records. The article spells out that in the year 2000, the Pentagon, quote, lost, unquote, that has disappeared, more than the $855 billion in individual taxes that had been the total collection of the IRS in 1999.
That's amazing.
And on September 10th, 2001, the day before the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, CBS News and Dan Rather reported that the Pentagon had, quote, lost $2.3 trillion, one quarter of its budget for the decade. Now, to put this in perspective, Helen Caldicott, the Australian nuclear activist, calculated that $1 trillion represents $1,000 spent every minute since the life of Jesus.
Ooh.
To give an understanding of the pillage of human production, of the resources of a starving planet that this criminal, rapacious gangster clique that is the ruling class in the United States represents.
The owners of the system stripping the system.
And mass murder is the integument which makes it possible, as your caller was indicating. And that, and what she had to say, was asking about with respect to the natural resources and oil is absolutely correct. It's absolutely correct that when Mossadegh nationalized the oil in Iran, the CIA installed the Shah in a putsch in 1953. But not only that, when the in Iraq, when Nouri as-Said, who is known as the stooge of Baghdad, of British imperialism, was overthrown, and the officers, the nationalist officers that came into power, specifically Abdul Karim Qasim in 1958, and they confined the areas in which the foreign oil companies could operate to 0.1% of the areas of Iraq, and they legalized the nationalist and communist parties in Iraq who were mobilizing the population for control of the resources and for distributing the land. The CIA set out to assassinate Abdul Karim Qasim, and the station chief there had a young asset who was in the right wing of the Ba'ath Party, a CIA asset named Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein carried out three attempts on the life of Abdul Karim Qasim. He finally succeeded in murdering him, and then he was put in charge of the torture interrogation. Hundreds of thousands of people passed through this. He was the CIA ruling class man in Baghdad for 27 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
That is the dynamic here of these regimes that they install to suppress the population, to rape their resources, to impoverish their populations. And American, North American kids are expected to exchange blood for oil.
Thanks for your call, Sydney. Bob, these are things that we've been following for quite a while. The whole rape and pillage of the system, where is it going to end?
Well, Lenny, the Israeli question about the Hamas that Sydney made, Ralph has done a lot of that.
I would like to address that.
If you have a minute, can you address that?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, because that's something very close to my heart. I absolutely agree with that.
Go ahead, Ralph.
The Mossad, literally with Saudi intelligence, created Hamas. It's well documented. I have the chapter and verse. I've discussed it. I don't recall.
Ralph,
it
do you want to give us your website for anybody who's listening?
Oh yes, please. If people would like to communicate with us, contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. PACBELL.net. We would like to make. We have a regular radio broadcast weekly in New York, and the programs and the cassettes and the tapes and the books and the pamphlets and the articles are available, and we'd love to hear from you. But Hamas and the Islamic fundamentalists, the far right fundamentalist groups, which were created by the Central Intelligence Agency, were specifically forged by the Mossad, and notably in Gaza. Because the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine were national and secular political movements. And interestingly enough, the program of the PLO and of the left organizations in Palestine was always very clear. They were opposed to the Zionist colonization of their country. They welcomed Jews to live as individual citizens with equal rights in their society. They said everybody understands the difference between emigrating to a place and colonizing it. It had nothing to do with hostility to Jews as such. It had everything to do with opposition to an imperial and colonial movement such as the Zionist movement and the Israeli state, which is founded upon the ethnic cleansing and purging of 90% of the Palestinian population, driving them out through a series of massacres, and then instituting laws in which in order to have the right to work on land or to lease it or to own it, you have to prove you have four generations of maternal Jewish descent.
Bob, take it away. And Ralph, thanks a lot. We'll certainly have you back as soon as possible.
Okay, did you want me to say...
Yeah, finish off, absolutely.
No, hold on, Ralph. We've got your website on the site, but I just want to say this, Ralph.
Yes.
You wrote a book on Bertrand Russell.
I wrote a book called Bertrand Russell, Philosopher of the Century, yes.
Yeah, well, we're going to go into more about this when you come back, but in a nutshell, what did you value about Bertrand Russell?
Well, Bertrand Russell was an extraordinary figure. He was the philosopher of the century, and he had led a most iconoclastic life in opposition to World War One. He was jailed in Great Britain because of that. He had challenged the repressive, puritanical sexual mores of the day with his book Marriage and Morals, and with the educational experiments that he undertook. He was a very audacious and courageous dissident figure in not just British cultural and intellectual life, but on a world scale. So for me to have that opportunity to be working in close association with him for 10 years was a great privilege.
Okay, Ralph, we have all the information about your site and your show on the WBAI up on our site. But if you want to say one last bit, repeat how people get in touch with you.
Well, I would like, if you give me a minute, I think I'd like to close on something that would be of interest to the listeners.
Okay.
Because we opened up by discussing the Mossad's telecommunications spying operations from Echelon to Converse to Amdocs to Odigo. And it's instructive to see who is, in fact, on the board of Odigo. It includes Alex Diamandis, and the people at Zim and the Ofer brothers. It includes Lord Black of Cross Harbor, chairman of the Telegraph Group Limited in London and director of the Jerusalem Post.
You mean Conrad Black?
Yes. And it includes Mrs. Black, who is the editor of the Toronto Sun from 1983 to 1985. I thought that you might, and I will mention others, of course, from Robert Strauss to Lord Weidenfeld to Richard Pearl to Henry Kissinger to Shmuel Maitar, who was president of the OREC Group, which includes Golden Channels, the largest cable television franchise in Israel. This is the link between the Mossad and the U.S. intelligence apparatus that both monitored and prepared 9/11. We can go into that again in some more particular detail when I come back. I would like to appreciate the chance for people to take down our how to contact us, which is to contact us at takingaim at pacbell.net, pacbell.net, and look forward to coming back and discussing these and other issues in more detail.
Wonderful. Thank you again, Ralph, and we look forward to having you back soon.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye, Ralph.
Okay, Bob, you there? Bob?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, now listen, we've got an emergency call in from Sherman.
Well, we'll do that later. Okay, now we're going to do the five bodies.
Okay, do you want to tell them where on the Internet? Just give the history here of the five bodies and where you pick it up. And it's at themedianews.com. They can go see the five bodies, those on the Internet, those who have access to the Internet right now. At mojoradio.com, they can get through to the Media News on our secret links and get to the five bodies listed there. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I'm going to go back to the very first caller in the first part of the show, asked this question, very detailed, comprehensive question, and it's a long story. We're going to do a lot of explaining this over the next weeks, and he's coming back to this segment explaining the cloning of ESP. But if we understand that the electric environment, from the telephone to movies to radio to television, that we see them as extensions of the way we communicate in our dream life. Think of it as our central nervous system. Think of the electric molding of us as an extension of how people communicate through their unconscious with other people. Now, with that as a collective element in the most of the 20th century, and then as it begins to be shrunk and miniaturized so that you, the consumer, can put on your VCR, put on your Walkman, and disconnect yourself from the general Ed Sullivan early middle 50s ESP, which was mandated on everybody, and then you could do it at your own pace, then you have the beginning of the shrinking of the cloned ESP on a mass level, and it becomes malleable and controlled by the individual.
Bob.
Now, just think of this.
Bob.
No, we'll get to that. Just want to finish the sentence.
Yeah.
The point is that think of as the electric environment gets smaller, that it becomes a body that is attached to you like a barnacle.
Okay, now at our website, we've got the five bodies, the neuron, the astral, the TV screen body, the chip, and the mystery body. Those are the five, correct?
Yes.
And how does this, I don't understand how these bodies fall in line with cloak and dagger, and I know it does, but could you explain a little bit? This is the bottom up that you're always talking about?
Yeah, this is the clothes that we wear. If we understand the communication systems we set up as our clothing. So that's the cloak.
So in other words, our technology, like right now there's a part of everybody who's got a cell phone connected to the electric environment who's connected to the satellite, so their brains are sort of connected there. Is that what you're talking, the extension of the body?
Yeah, they're connected and resonating. It's a resonating acoustic space more than visually linked. It is something that we are rubbing up against each other, millions of us, the whole planet. Now, that is the neuron body, which was set up with the telephone and radio. But when you had the TV body, which had all the sensory lights, including sight, then you have a dominant body, and we call that the TV screen or body. Now, that's miniaturized. The TV environment's become smaller and smaller over the last 50 years. What has come in since the TV body is the chip body. Now, that's the Internet. That's the digital world, the satellites, the fiber optics, the cell phones. That is an invisible thing. We don't see the interconnections and the resonating effect of that. We see it still through the screen. So you have the TV screen becomes a barnacle inside you and outside. Then the chip body becomes, as it gets smaller and tinier and tighter, a barnacle on the inside and outside of you. But originally, we had a physical body, which is something that's a mystery. We don't fully know what it is. Every culture attempts to map it. And also we have an invisible astral or spiritual or something that's, that many cultures think refers to life after death. So we call that the astral body. So in the end, you have a physical mystery body and you have the astral body. That is paralleled by the TV body and the chip body. The chip body is an invisible body that parallels the astral. So there's the ratio.
All right. Listen, we do have to go to break. When we come back, you can finish off if you have any further. I don't know how well everybody understands it. I think poetry communicates long before it is understood. Bob Sleeper wants to jump in here off the Internet. He's been going to give us a quick Internet update, and he has a question for you.
Well, Bob, I get the feeling here that Lenny thinks that some people didn't understand what you just said, I don't think I understood perfectly. Here's my challenge. Let's have someone call up, see if we can get a caller who didn't understand a word Bob said. And one, I don't think you'll get that caller. And two, if you do, that guy will leave the phone understanding exactly, or leaving with a new understanding.
Yeah, Bob, this understanding of the different bodies all in one, are they all in one simultaneous, Bob?
Yes, they're all resonating now and emerging. But Lenny, the point is why would anybody understand me? I'm just presenting a whole new psychology, a whole new theory of knowledge, and the structure of our being. This is going to take months for people to understand. I haven't even had a chance to properly lay it out. I've just said the words.
Yeah.
So I don't think we should demand people understand me immediately.
We'll put it up on the net and direct them to the net before the show, and then you can hit the high Sierras of the whole thing. You know, we've got...
But let me just say this, Lenny. The thing is if people start to try to visualize the space we're all in right now, which is internet, telephone, the net. You can't see that space.
You can visualize it.
Yes.
Cyberspace.
You can hear it and you can feel it. Now, think of that as an imitation of ESP, that goes on between people when they're in the coffee shops, when they're in the bars, the body language. This is a new kind of body language that McLuhan would call discarnate, that it's electrified resonance. Now, that's just the beginning of the percept I'm trying to get people to see.
So this
will take a while. Take a while to work on it.
These are the effects behind the cloak that are invisible to people. Is that it?
Right. Now, the dagger is the human being coming in and hogging the content, and including distracting effects with the content, saying this is what it is. As an example, I could be charged with being a dagger right now because I'm trying to put a definition on this resonating field we live in. I'm trying to use some English words to encapsulate it. I'm, in a way, hijacking it. But then when you get all the other content we had, then we have on the media, then that's all kinds of battles over stating what opinion applies to the proper content, and there's a lot of knifing in the back behind the scenes, and that's dagger.
All right, now listen. That's a great subject that we can develop. I know this is your.
We will develop it.
Pardon me?
We will develop it.
Yeah, we will develop it. In the meantime, we do have an exciting friend on the phone from Chicago. Sherman Skolnick, Citizens Committee to Clean Up the Courts, is going to give us some, connect the dots here between Cheney and Bush and the snipers, and I think we should get into that.
How much time do we have to discuss this?
Yeah, you there, Sherman? Welcome to the show.
We got 5 minutes, Sherman. All right. There is a business competition unknown to the public between George W. Bush and Richard Cheney, okay? Those of us that are well-informed know that the Bush family has interest with Union Oil of California, UNICAL, which has been planning since 97 to build a pipeline through Afghanistan, and that in its simplest form is the reason for the Afghanistan war, to have the pipeline as a shortcut through Afghanistan to Pakistan, India, and points east. What is not fairly well known to the public is the largest oil reserves in the world appear to be in Siberia, and there is there being built a pipeline of which Richard Cheney has a financial interest. And that pipeline is headed east through a part of Red China into North Korea, and eventually through by tanker or other means that the oil would get to Japan, which needs that type of energy. Now, why this is important right now, and by the way, this information that came out about North Korea and the nuclear is all part of the same thing, because the ones that are promoting the Siberian pipeline are Gazprom, G-A-Z-P-R-O-M, and they are on the outs with the Bush, what some people call the Bush crime family. Now, the key piece of information is the Afghanistan pipeline is based on figures that have been released that are believed to be inaccurate. In other words, the oil from the Caspian is only 40% of what they claim it is, so that the Afghanistan pipeline is not any longer feasible from a financial standpoint. So this helps explain a growing split between Richard Cheney and George W. Bush on financial. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yes.
Because of the time limits, I can't go into all the details, but we know a lot about it.
How does this go into the link with the sniper now?
The sniper teams are a leftover, which the Pentagon does not want to reveal to the local police, of a thing that originally was called White Star Project, later was called the Phoenix Assassination Program in Vietnam, and some of those snipers trained by the U.S. military to shoot the infrastructure and kill the infrastructure in among the Viet Cong in Vietnam are now in this country. And it's not a lone assassin. There are teams as many as 10 people. And the police are stymied. They can't tell the press about it. They can't tell the public about it because the Pentagon will not cooperate with them and tell them who are former Phoenix assassination snipers trained in teams of 10 who are experts at deception. They use scanner radios. They know what the police are up to. The white truck is one of their tricks where they direct an innocent white truck to a place where they want to kill somebody, and then they pretend to be the truck's dispatcher, and they say, hey, you came to the wrong address. You got to go in a hurry someplace else. It is at that point that they kill somebody in that parking lot, that gas station, that Ponderosa or other fast
right.
food place.
And the police
ride the white truck. And the white truck is completely innocent. It's a truck that was directed, a repair truck or a delivery truck, of which there are many, to come to that address. And then when it comes there, at that point they kill somebody, the snipers, and then they pretend to be the dispatcher, and on the cell phone they talk to the driver of the white truck, you're at the wrong address. Go to this other address in a hurry.
All right, Sherman, why are these American snipers doing this?
Well, you'd have to know the White Star Project, and you'd have to know, time doesn't...
Well, you've got a couple minutes.
There are things in the Western side with the assassination program. There, the U.S. terrorized and eventually assassinated a lot of the infrastructure. And frankly, and I'm trying to be very careful about this because I'm not in favor of violence, but the sniper teams, in a way,
yeah.
are sort of pointing the finger toward the White House to the extent like, hey, If we need to take out somebody in the White House, we can do that too.
Okay.
So, in other words, it might be a road to an emergency, to martial law, to deal with the growing financial meltdown in the United States, which 9-1-1 was a diversion to sidestep the financial meltdown. But the financial meltdown, I think you gentlemen know, is still there. It's still happening in North America. And so that, but the main thing is little known that there is this financial fight between the Richard Cheney interests, Halliburton, and he's got a big investment there, the Siberian pipeline, that is Red China, North Korea, Japan, and the Afghanistan pipeline, which is the George Bush financial people, and that pipeline is no longer feasible. Why?
Sherman, what is your source on this?
We've asked Sherman to...
What is your source on this information?
We've asked Sherman. He's going to be coming back next Sunday to start off the show.
Well, let me answer his question.
So go ahead.
There's hardly a White House reporter that we talk to off the record that doesn't know that these two pipeline deals, the one in Afghanistan, they turn out to be the biggest accounting fraud, possibly bigger than Enron, bigger than WorldCom, because they lured investors that invested with the Bush crime family in this pipeline deal on the basis of the reserves of oil and natural gas, and they're only 40% of what they claimed. So there's going to be a big commotion. On the other hand, Richard Cheney and French interests and Russian interests with Gazprom on the Siberian pipeline, there are much more reserves there, and the price of oil will be lower per barrel from there, and it will help Red China, North Korea, and Japan. And notice, the North Korea scandal about their nuclear came out just as somebody went on the air on another program and started to talk about the two pipelines. That is, Richard Cheney's pipeline deal as compared to George W. Bush's pipeline deal, which are competitors. This is going to lead to a lot of trouble. Some people go so far as to say that there are different competing sniper teams operating in the Beltway, and that, heaven forbid, we may see a great deal of more of violence, which may lead into some kind of a declaration of a national emergency.
That's amazing.
The Pentagon, meanwhile, is not cooperating with the local police to give out the names and current addresses of those who were trained snipers in the Phoenix assassination program, of which what is happening now is similar. Because of the time limits, I have to be very brief in discussing this. But the point is, these two competing pipelines, one is going to be so apparently to be ill-advised, if not actually allegedly fraudulent, that they overstated the reserves that would support the building of the pipeline.
Okay, Sherman, listen, thank you for joining us and filling us in.
We're give out our website address, because we'll have stories posted about that in the future.
It's on our website, your link. If you want to get to Sherman, you can get to him through our website. We've got, thanks for joining us again, Sherman, and we'll see you next
Thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks a lot. Bob, well, this has been exciting. We're looking forward to getting back next week with Sherman. We're also going to have Jeff Steinberg on the show. So the last word is yours, Bob Dobbs.
I just want to say that Deep Throat, later known as Too Deep, understood what the Android meme was. He understood that when you asked the question about too much propaganda, he answered and said, it's the Android meme talking to itself. So Deep Throat left with the main insight, even though he ran away on the top-down field level. His bottom-up understanding will keep him afloat.